teeth the clean teeth.
All together now. This is Eleanor LeCain. As part of our treasure hunt for solutions, today we're talking about creating alternatives to violence and reducing drug addiction. Here to help us explain and understand solutions to these problems is Roger Kluck. Roger works at the Alternatives to Violence Project with 45 years' experience reducing recidivism and addiction. Their approach has been fine-tuned over 45 years of work in over 60 countries. They're active in 100 prisons in the U.S. and have over 2,000 trained inmate facilitators working inside. Their experience comes from the trenches. They are reducing violence and trauma in many of the most violent environments with the most violent populations. The approach they developed for work with prisoners is now being used much more broadly for addiction work, gang recovery, domestic violence, and sexual assault recovery. Roger Kluck has spent 15 years going into prisons doing this work. In addition, he has trained people in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Iran, as well as working with the State Department and the World Affairs Council to share his experience with this effective methodology with people from over 30 countries. Roger Kluck, welcome to All Together Now.
Hi, thank you, Eleanor.
So for those who haven't heard yet of the Alternatives to Violence Project, just kind of give us the headline of what is the Alternative to Violence Project.
Well, it started in 1975 as an anti-violence program in a prison in New York, Greenhaven Prison. The older inmates, this was shortly after the Attica prison riots, and for those who aren't familiar with that, the Attica prison riots, the inmates revolted, took hostages, and were after things like better some programming. There was almost no social programming, no help for problems, food issues, the whole gamut of things. But in the end, Governor Rockefeller sent in the National Guard, I believe, or the state police, and 38 or 48 people were shot. Anyway, all of that was the backdrop to this, and the inmates were afraid that the facility they were in could explode like that, and they wanted a program to reduce violence, especially among the younger folks. And they formed a group inside called the Think Tank, social activists. People don't think of inmates as activists, but it's the same as any community. There's a lot of guys inside trying to improve their world and the larger world. But anyway, the Think Tank reached out. They found out there was a Quaker visiting program. They reached out to them for assistance, the Quakers being a peace church, very active in the civil rights movement and abolition and so forth, and generally conscientious objectors in time of war and so forth. They reached out to them saying, you know a lot about this. Together they spent 3 years combing the literature, looking at what was going on out there, and helped develop this program, came to this program. And so that's its roots. That's where it started. But it pretty quickly went from prison to prison. Inmates would get transferred and say, I want this here, or they'd write their friends about how to...
So when you say they want this, you're talking about the prisoners themselves came up with a program of what they thought would help the people who are in prison to reduce violence. Is that right?
Well, they initiated it and then put in a lot of the research work and collaborated with the Quakers to get it in place, yes.
Yeah, so it's a particular program that's been taught since they created it in prison for prisoners, right? So why do you think this program is important for our listeners to know about?
Well, it's kind of a panacea for so much of what's wrong in our society. There's so mm-hmm. much trauma, so much suffering, so much pain. While the program started as an anti-violence program, we really quickly learned that its ramifications were far bigger than that. Starting as an anti-violence program, we learned pretty quickly, there's a saying in the field that hurt people hurt people. So mm-hmm. most of the inmates, that the more violent an inmate was, the more we realized that they had suffered, and the more pain and suffering they had. And the program pretty quickly found out that the most effective way to reduce violence was to work on that pain and suffering rather than trying to teach the skills. I mean, we'd still teach skills, but until you remove that pain and that suffering, you're not going to get great results. And that's where I think we differ, is that we really work on the individual's pain and suffering and history and getting them to a place of nonviolence.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. I mean, just to underscore that for our listeners, that the most effective way to reduce violence is to reduce the pain and suffering that led to the violence. So it's fine to have various techniques or things that people do, but and the key is really to reduce that pain and suffering. And I was struck when our friend Betty Lynn Brown introduced us near Seattle this past fall, when you and I met for the first time. I was struck when you talked about how rampant it is among the prison population, how rampant trauma is, and not only among the prison population, but among the general population, and that you've got a whole technique and approach that can help anybody who's had experienced some kind of trauma and the pain and suffering that comes with trauma. Is that right?
When you start talking about dealing with pain and suffering and trauma, you start to find out that it's not just violence that you're working on. You're reducing suicide, you're reducing depression, you're reducing alienation, all of these different social ills. Addiction is part of that, because most people, mm-hmm. In my experience, the vast, vast majority of addicts I've come in contact with are self-medicating really severe trauma. So mm-hmm. So anyway, it starts to, as I say, it becomes an answer to so many problems that our society faces.
Right, exactly. And I love that it's got such wide applicability, and I love that it came out of an initiative from the prisoners themselves, and now that, you know, from inside the prison with the program they've created, starting to expand and help other people. But so explain a little bit, this is like when you talk about a panacea, I know people wonder, well, how could you possibly do a program that's going to address trauma in a way that reduces violence, reduces depression, suicide, addiction? Describe a little bit of this Alternative to Violence Project. What do you do exactly? How long is the program, and how does it work?
The program, in its ideal format, best practices kind of format, is three full days, 3, 7, or 8 hour days back to back. And it's an experiential process. We drew from a program called Creative Conflict Resolution for Children, which the Quakers had developed, and found that it had to be interesting and fun. So it's entirely experiential. We don't lecture at the people. And with that, it's a peer-to-peer, it's a facilitated process where the learning actually comes from the participants. So we have a curated set of exercises that is carefully arranged to slowly bring, well, actually pretty quickly, bring them into community. And I want to just say that, too, is that the program is an incredibly powerful tool for community building and overcoming differences. But we start with some lighthearted games that get people laughing. And some people feel that this is, when you look at it, at first we're playing games that look like elementary school. And some people shake their heads. But I got to tell you, I do workshops in prison, and I'll have white supremacists, Bloods, Crips, Norteños, Sereños, all these different gangs in there. And we get them playing together like children, and pretty soon they're laughing and giggling, and they're falling. We do a game like musical chairs that mixes them all up. They come in and they sit in what they call their cars. It's their gang. You sit with your members. Of course, you sit with the people you know. And through this musical chairs game, we get them crisscrossing, running around the circle and falling down, laughing next to people that they wouldn't ordinarily deal with. I'm sorry, I'm kind of wandering there, but that's...
No, this is good. I'm sitting here in Washington, D.C., thinking I wish you could bring this to D.C. to help the people here get along and get our government back working.
Yeah, you're reminding me that a long time ago on some piece program, I heard somebody saying somewhere in a cafe in Palestine, an Israeli and a Jew are saying, what is it with those Democrats and Republicans in Congress? Why can't they get along?
Right, exactly. So you've got your a three-day program. So you're saying that you're working with this program that's been designed starting with the prisoners and the Quakers and evolving from them, but that essentially you've got a three-day program people can go through, and at the end of it, they will have dealt with their trauma in such a way that will reduce violence, addiction, and depression, and so forth. So what else are you doing in the 3 days that leads to that claim?
Well, we start, as I say, these lighthearted games set a light mood, and then we slowly start moving into getting them to know each other and sharing. For example, we do an exercise where you have to talk to, you're paired up with one individual, and you each share for 2 minutes what you like about yourself. And that's kind of gutsy or difficult for some folks, especially if you're in a jail or prison where a lot of folks have given up thinking positively about themselves. But then we take those two and put them together with another group and say, introduce your new friend. So I'd be saying, you know, this is Eleanor. She really enjoys radio work. She does this, she does that. And I'd be talking about, I'd be introducing you, and you hear yourself introduced in it in a way that creates a little self-esteem and recaptures some pride. But you're also getting to know that as this goes around, you're finding out you have a lot in common with the others. So we have a lot of discussions that involve gradually getting more and more vulnerable, and with that comes more and more trust. And we work on this community-building process. Often, mm-hmm. In fact, when I do a workshop, people will come out saying, I know these people better in 3 days than I've known people that I've known my whole life.
Wow.
That's
impressive.
It's a very, very common feedback we get. And we slowly move into, so we do community building, communication, and self-esteem on the first day. Then we move into trust and connection. And it's not until the emphasis on the third day turns into conflict skills and how to resolve conflicts nonviolently and so forth. But we find, like, you know, we're doing in those first days a lot of empathy building and a lot of a lot of empathy and compassion work and finding that you have so much in common with people. And that, in fact, is one of the biggest cures for violence, because if I have empathy for you, how can I hurt you? If I see that you're like me, that's why, you know, these hate groups and things, they all demonize the other. But we tear that down pretty quickly by mixing folks up with people they wouldn't normally sit with, talk with, et cetera. If I may, I just did a workshop a few months ago, and we had a number of white supremacists, or I should say former white supremacists, in the group. And it's one of the joys of this work is I get to see lots of former white supremacists and former gang members, former practitioners of hate. But this fellow, we do a written evaluation at the end, and we ask, what did you learn in the workshop? And this fellow wrote, I learned that I have Mexican, black, orange, crazy, funny, scared, influential brothers, and they are all in my life forever now.
Wow, what a beautiful testimonial.
And this is somebody who was all tattooed up in white power emblems and so forth. And so this is what keeps me coming back to this work, because every time I go in for 3 days, I see several epiphanies like this.
That's really moving. What a tribute to the work that you're doing there. You know, one thing I'm wondering, as you're talking about building empathy and trust among these gang members and white supremacists, so forth, is that I just talked to a lady who wrote a book on sociopaths and the sociopaths and psychopaths who don't have empathy, and that there is a higher representation of sociopaths among the prison population. So, you know, what happens when you get there and you're doing this program designed to build empathy, but there's people there? Have you seen people who they can't build empathy because they don't have the connection, they don't have the ability to build on that and from themselves? Have you run into that problem at all?
Well, it's a fascinating question, and I've read a lot on sociopaths and psychopaths and pondered it in this work. I got to say, the people that we get in the workshop, they have to volunteer for the workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see people who want to change. And so we don't tend to see the folks who aren't interested in change. So I think that keeps a certain number of these people out.
Mm-hmm.
Though I've got to say, too, I feel like I recognize there must be people out there that we can't reach, but I've had, I'm thinking of one fellow when he wanted to come to a workshop, several of the inmates said, we don't want him. He's a psychopath. He's manipulative, and he does everything with an ulterior motive. And I've got to say, I've been working with him for over 5 years now, and he's one of our facilitators, and he's amazing.
Oh, so my God. This is really
people,
remarkable.
For a lot of people who feel that they don't, you know, who haven't had the history of it, there it's still nascent there. You can still reach it and pull it out, I'm convinced. That's not to say that there's that 1 or 2% of sociopaths that, you know, they may be there, but I really haven't seen them.
No, I totally believe it. And as some of my listeners know, my husband and I adopted a girl when she was 5 years old, and she was, you know, what they call, you know, lack of connection and enormous behavior challenges. I had a lot of trauma when she was very young and kind of was fighting and difficult. But I guess it was probably my Christian upbringing that I really believe that every person can heal and be made whole in the right environment. So I just thought, well, here's a young one who had a really rough start. Maybe we can give her enough love and support and guidance to help her reclaim her life. So I'm happy to report she's now in her 20s, and we had some very many rough years, but she did heal, and she has become whole, and she got through high school, and she's not into drugs, she's not into alcohol, all the stuff that a lot of the people who experience trauma turn to for self-medication, as you mentioned. So she's thriving. And not to say it was easy, it wasn't. It was the hardest thing I've ever done. But I do believe that every person has the potential to become heal and hold in the right environment, and we just need to find what that environment is. And it sounds like you've designed a three-day environment that really helps people who have had profound challenges in their lives really turn themselves around. So hats off to you.
Well, that's excellent with your daughter. That's fantastic. And it's interesting you say that. We really do, I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but we really do create an environment of safety that's missing in the jails and the prison and elsewhere. And, in fact, a lot of the inmates say this is the closest we'll get to a vacation while we're in here, because they can entirely unplug from the prison environment and all of the rules and strictures of that life.
Yeah, very good. So, what would you say to someone like my daughter? And trauma now, and I'd like you to talk about just how pervasive trauma is, not just among the prison population, which I assume is 100% there have experienced trauma. If nothing else, they're going through the trauma of being in prison. But even in the broader population, how pervasive trauma is, and then what of what you're doing could help someone like my daughter?
Okay, yeah, this is probably a good place to mention ACEs. In 96, two doctors, Folletti and I can't, and ANDA, A-N-D-A, released a study with a Kaiser Permanente group out of California, a very robust study, 18,000 people. And it started, if you'll forgive me making this a little long, but it's important, it started as a study on obesity, and they were studying obesity, and a number of people were dropping out, and they tended to be people who had major weight losses and gains, so they started interviewing them to try to find out why they were dropping out, to try to coax them back into the study. And one of the doctors, on his first visit, he met this woman and said, you know, asked her all sorts of questions, how much she weighed, at what ages and things, and spitballing his way through this, he didn't have written questions. He said, how old did you weigh at your first sexual experience? And she started sobbing and said, 90 pounds, I was 9 years old, it was my father.
Oh my God, how horrible.
And he said, I've been, you know, he said in the back of my mind, he said, I've been a physician for 40 years, and this is the second incest story I've heard. He said, little did I realize over the next 3 months I'd hear 20 more. And so they started to realize the connection between obesity and sexual abuse. And so they expanded further, and they came up with 10 categories of neglect and abuse, whether physical abuse, neglect, sexual abuse, life challenges like single parent, a parent with mental illness, parent with alcoholism or addiction, a number of these things. And they came up with a checklist of 10 things, and they found that if you have a score of 5 on this, you're 17 times more likely to try to commit suicide. You're 10 times more likely to be an alcoholic. You're 17 times, I believe it is, more likely to be an IV drug user. So they found this, you know, all of these impacts that in childhood, so it's called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. And research in my state, in Washington, found that in 10th and 12th grade, 30% of the kids have scores of 5 or higher, or 4 or higher, which is profoundly traumatized. I mean, you know, you're talking, again, 17 times or 15 times more likely to do IV drugs at those scores. So 30% of the population coming out of high school has this kind of trauma. and then you go into the world and you have
wait, 35%?
About a third. 30% coming.
What, about a third coming out of high, this is just like your average public high school?
Yeah.
And you think that's like nationwide,
that's,
or is that in like
that's
troubled area?
Nationwide. The study in California had similar kinds of numbers, and there it was a very privileged group because it was a Kaiser Permanente study, so all these people had enough income or jobs that gave them health insurance. This was
one third of the population has got some traumatic background.
At 18.
At age 18.
And then you figure that's an age at which men are joining the military and going off into combat. Women are going to college and facing sexual assault and rape in their life. Domestic violence and marriages, all of these things that happen to us in adulthood. I've come to believe that easily 50-60% of the population carries really substantial levels of trauma.
Yeah, that makes sense to me, particularly when you look at a lot of the behaviors that would, and that could be underlying a lot of like the drug addiction and the alcoholism that's out there. So what if one of our listeners is one of these people who has experienced trauma, whether early in life or a little bit later, do you have any advice for what they can do? Like, can they take this Alternatives to Violence program somewhere? Are there principles from the program that they can apply in their own lives? Or what do you recommend to help our listeners?
Well, the workshop is, of course, you know, a full 3-day experience, and that's the ideal. Trauma treatment, though, you know, if you can't get to an AVP workshop, try to find, you know, some place to get trauma treatment, because especially in terms of addiction, so many of us know that people in recovery often go to rehab 6, 7, 8, 9 times. I think the average is something like 7 trips to rehab. And I've come to believe that a lot of that is because we're treating addiction as the disease. And in reality, to my thinking, trauma is the disease, and addiction is a symptom of the disease. So as long as you're just treating the symptom, the disease is going to continue to reemerge. So some kind of trauma treatment, whether it's with a counselor or, you know, programs, peer counseling, whatever you can find. Of course, I highly recommend the programs, and we are in something like 35 states. In a number of those states, though, we're mostly in prison, but lots of places we're doing community workshops, and I do some work with a recovery cafe here also.
Okay, so you're in 35 states, mostly in prison, but someone's not in prison. You do some in the communities? Like, how would they access those workshops?
Well, we have, let me find the phone number here, a national number, 888-278-7820. That's 888-278-7820. And you can ask there where you can, you know, where the closest place you can find a workshop is. I'd also recommend a couple books for people to understand trauma.
Good.
One is Trauma and Recovery by Judith Herman.
Trauma and Recovery.
That one focuses a lot, especially on sexual trauma. It's called A Feminist Perspective on Trauma. But it's an interesting thing that they came to realize that the women traumatized sexually were exhibiting a lot of the same symptoms that Vietnam veterans were, and that was kind of when the notion of PTSD started to emerge. Anyway, and another book called The Body Keeps Score by Van der Kolk.
The Body Keeps Score. That sounds interesting.
That's I think, just a year old now, and he's a Harvard professor and has done evaluations of all the different techniques and has been involved in a lot of the studies to compare the different methodologies. So I'd say that's going to be the new Bible, if it isn't already, on trauma and trauma treatment.
Wow, fantastic. I love that. And so I appreciate you creating this resource, and particularly for the prisoners, but now really with much wider applicability. And do you have any research done on your own program? Like, how do you know how effective it is, and do you track the people who go and what happens to them? What kind of data do you have on that?
Yeah, I'm conducting some ongoing research. I'm doing a program in a jail here with incarcerated veterans. So we'll soon be doing our 50th workshop. So I've worked with about 600 veterans. All of them have PTSD, and we're looking particularly, our research there is on anger levels.
Just for our listeners today, PTSD, you're talking about post-traumatic stress syndrome, which a lot of, you know, probably all veterans have or have seen combat, but also that was something I diagnosed my daughter at 5 years old, had post-traumatic stress. So, yes,
and,
so
and again,
go ahead.
We're talking 30% of the kids graduating from college have levels that are, so we're finding that, I've seen studies that say 30-35% of the people had trauma before they, and had PTSD before they joined the military. So which only makes sense with these school studies and things. But anyway, we're doing research. We do an anger survey, a psychological measure on anger before and after the workshop. And we found preliminarily, we're a long ways from publication, but we've been looking at the data as it comes in. I'm particularly interested in a type of anger called trait anger, which is what your thermostat setting is for anger. How angry are you generally? That contrasts with state anger, which is your current state. So if I reach over and slap you, your anger is going to go up. Your state anger is reflective of what's happening right now. But trait anger is kind of where your thermostat is stuck at. And the veterans, shockingly, are 22% above normal for men their age out on the street. To compare that to other things, men in prison are 6% higher than normal, and men in psychiatric hospitals are 9% above normal. But my vets are 22% above.
Wow, so they're walking around with a lot of anger.
Totally, and they talk about, you know, they say most people go from 0 to 100 in their anger. They say, we start at 80. And so, you know, we see a lot of domestic violence, a lot of assault cases, a lot of violence in this population, unfortunately. But they do the workshop, and it drops 38 points to 15 points below normal.
Wow.
Below normal. And that, it's easy to think that's just an effect of the workshop. However, we've got research out of Minnesota done in a prison that showed very similar drops. And there he was able to go back 2 years later and do a follow-up. And the fellows were still substantially below normal. So this is mind-blowing to me, because in one or two workshops, 20 to 40 hours, we're rewiring the brain. I mean, we are making long-term changes that are holding with them years afterwards. Similarly, in Delaware, we had a study, a recidivism study, that looked at guys who took the workshop and followed up 3 years after their release from prison. And you have to realize, too, some of these guys are taking this a year, 2-3 years before they're released from prison. But 3 years after release, they were half as likely, 47% less likely to go back to prison. So here's again, 20, 40 hours worth of work, 5-6 years later, having this profound impact. And in fact, that's one of our biggest challenges, is the results are so stunning that when we show them to professionals, they frequently don't believe it, and they think, you know, we're inflating this stuff. It's
Well, that's why I'm asking about the data, because these are big claims, and the scientists are going to want data to back up the claim, so that's good that you're getting the research done.
Yeah, I was having a conversation with one of my colleagues and saying, you know, one of our biggest problems is how do we convince people that we're making such dramatic brain changes in 20 hours? And he said, I really don't see what the problem is, because trauma totally rewires your brain in 5 minutes. I think
right.
He's got a point there. We're, you know, if you can have such profound impacts in minutes, a calculated methodology over 20 hours to counter that 5 minutes can have some really strong effects.
Yeah. Well, and it's great that you're working with the vets there, but it would seem like pretty much all the vets could benefit from what you're doing. Are you partnering with the Veterans Administration and teaching them how to do it so they can reach all the vets? Or how do we get this going to scale in a bigger way for the people who could benefit from it?
Well, we have tried to reach out to the VA on occasion, but we still haven't got our research done in a way that is I think, you know, convincing for them. But that said, I was just out yesterday at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, one of the largest military bases here at Madigan Hospital, and we're in discussion with them there for what they call warrior transition brigades. These are folks who've been injured either physically or psychologically and are preparing or being transitioned either back to civilian service or trying to be rehabilitated. I understand 40% go back to their unit, but 60% leave. But we're still, frankly, trying to figure out how to get in there. There's several people who want us, but it's the military and there's a lot of paperwork.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, let's hope that what you have can be made more available to more of the people.
Yeah, while we're talking vets, there's a point I'd really love to share with the public that on my advocacy side that I feel more people need to know about, and that is that if you are discharged from the military with a dishonorable discharge or what's called other than honorable discharge, you're not entitled to any VA benefits. And what we're finding is happening a lot is fellows have combat exposure, they get PTSD, and if they get a drug arrest before they're discharged, before they get an honorable discharge, if they get in trouble, again, we mentioned these anger issues, so they may backtalk or hit an officer or they'll use drugs, and they get dishonorably discharged because of their PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
And that precludes them from getting any help with their PTSD from the VA. It shuts them out of the VA PTSD program. So it's a great injustice. The VA has made a few small changes last year to try to help with this some, but it's a real shame. I mean, these folks that were injured in service to their country are rejected from the help that's available to the.
Yeah, and very interesting.
As an aside, to take that one step farther, if you forgive me, is the
sure. Go ahead.
The worst element of this is there are hundreds of immigrants with green cards or otherwise who joined the military and offered to serve for citizenship in return for citizenship in the country, and when they get in trouble with drugs or such, they're driven to the border. They don't get their citizenship, and I've read there's at least 300 veterans in Mexico who, you know, were driven there by ICE and deported veterans, not able to get the help they need for the PTSD that led to them being deported.
Well, we absolutely want to get this program more available to more people. And so I'm wondering, Roger, you're obviously very dedicated to this. How did you first get involved in this Alternative to Violence project? Hello, Roger?
sorry. I hit the cough button there for a moment.
Whoops, yeah. I was just asking you how you got involved. Obviously, we want to get more people trained, and so this work can be done to broader populations.
Right.
How did you get involved?
Well, I had honestly been a lawyer for 25 years, an environmental lawyer, and I had a health crisis. Took a year for them to figure out what it was, a year to get well, and when I came back, I knew I didn't want to go back to the courts and the stress of that. And I took a job with the Quakers lobbying on prison reform issues. And so especially what we call recidivism issues, trying to help guys be more successful when they got out. And somebody invited me to come into prison to see a workshop. And I'd been working in a lot of transition houses with guys getting out, but I hadn't had an opportunity to actually go into prison. So I went in, and the work just blew me away from the very first day, and the experience was so profound, and it was really helpful for myself too. I mean, mm-hmm. doing this work has helped me be a better father and husband without question. So after I stopped lobbying on those issues, I've continued and pretty much thrown all my effort into AVP since then.
Well, that's interesting. Well, so how does this work on trauma help you be a better father and husband?
Well, it's a lot of things. I have a little bit of my own trauma, but it also teaches conflict skills. It teaches how part of what we teach in the later part of the program is how to identify your needs and communicate your needs to others in ways where they want to listen and want to help you meet those needs. And all of that training in empathy and understanding and compassion comes to play. I mean, you know, if you've got compassion and empathy with your kids, you're going to be a better father. If you don't let yourself get triggered into the yelling and screaming that may mm-hmm. come with teenagehood from time to time.
Right.
All of that has helped, and it's taught me, you know, what my wife would say, to fight fair.
when that's great. I love that.
Discussion.
And who else is doing AVP? You're one man. You're obviously dedicated and doing a lot. And who else do you consider part of this Alternative to Violence project?
Oh, thanks. That's an important question, because we have about 5,000 facilitators around the world.
Oh, wow.
And in the U.S., I think we're at about 2,500, and about 1,500 of those are inmates inside. When we go inside, we train facilitators there. When we go to schools, we try to bring youth facilitators. It's always important to us to try to have team members. It's a team project, I have to say, too, so that we always work with others, other facilitators, ideally three or four, so that it keeps one's ego in check. You're not delivering, you know, you're just part of the team managing a process, and the process is what works, and we're trained simply to deliver this process, and the process has been fine-tuned for over 44 years now in 60 countries, so it's gotten to be really perfect, perfected to a really high degree.
Yeah, that's terrific. And I'm wondering, you know, how would people, our listeners here, maybe get involved if they want to be a facilitator or bring an Alternatives to Violence Project session into their community? How would they do that?
That phone number, again, is a good place to start. That's 888-278-7820. Or you can email info at avpusa.org. And as I say, we're in 35 states. I have something like 15 facilitators in my local working with me, and I think our group is like, our chapter is like many. We say if you get 15 people that say they want a workshop, we will get somebody there to run it for, you know, to make it work for you.
Wow, that's impressive. Good for you. And I would imagine it was kind of a little bit shocking. You were a lawyer, environmental lawyer, and then you get involved in this Quaker project with the prisoners. What was it like for you going into prison for the first time?
Well, it was kind of amusing to me, actually, because my father was in the military. Mm-hmm. I grew up on Navy bases all around the world, and so I lived inside the barbed wire for probably half of my life, and everything was painted institutional gray and mm-hmm. So forth. And the first time I went into prison, it was a maximum security prison, and everything had all the metalwork was painted navy gray and all the barbed wire, and I felt very comfortable. They tell you you're going to be frightened when the doors clang behind you. I found myself sort of going, "Where's Dad?" But what was much more disturbing to me is after that I went to a minimum security prison. And there it looked like a college campus, except there were guard towers with guys with guns and razor wire everywhere. And that juxtaposition, this feeling of being on a college campus with this oppressive presence, was more disconcerting for me. I want to tell you a little story, though, about my first time in. Part of what locked me into this program is on the second day of the workshop, a Saturday, I'm sitting next to this guy, and he's a Blood gang member, all the tattoos and all, and he interrupted the workshop in the middle of some exercise and said, "I just have to say something." And the facilitator looked to him, "I'm in here as a participant doing the same thing the inmates are." And he says, he looks at me and he says, "I'm a gangsta, and you're supposed to be afraid of me." And he says, "But you're talking to me like I'm your next door neighbor." Says, "I don't know what's going on here, but I really like it."
Oh, what a great compliment. That's terrific. Good for you.
So that's kind of what AVP does. I mean, we were talking across these divides and preconceptions, and it just hooked me.
Right. And well, and that's why I talk about the context that you create in which the skills are taught, but it's really a whole environment that you're creating. And I've seen this in the breakthrough programs for children with autism. They say the key is, you know, surround yourself and the child with love. And within that context, then, there's lots of things you can teach to a child to help them learn to communicate. But if you're feeling, you know, guilty about having a child who's got autism or disappointed or regretful the child isn't, like, highly verbal or what you were hoping for, then no matter what you have for skills isn't going to get across, because you absolutely need that context of understanding and compassion for any of the skills to take root. So it sounds like you do a great job of creating that in these programs you run.
That's a lot of it. I like to say there's something called mirror neurons, which the research has shown when we see somebody doing something, these neurons are triggered in us as if we were doing it ourselves, and it's considered the neural basis for empathy. And I like to say we play that like a harp. We just, over 3 days, go back there again and again and again, so mm-hmm. that you feel the connection to each other and you feel the empathy and you start to feel that you're not at all different.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I know there's different types of workshops kind of similar to the Alternatives to Violence project. And can you talk a little bit about what else is out there and how your program is different from the others?
Sure. I've done a lot of different trainings. I'm a mediator and done a lot of different trainings. Nonviolent communication is very popular, NVC. By mm-hmm. Marshall Rosenberg. It's a very good program. It's technique-driven. Where we're different, I think, is that that program focuses a lot on when this is said, I should say this. And it's to us, very heady. It's technique-driven. It's and over time, it may change your heart some. But we work actually on changing people's emotions are, their heart. We say ours is heart work, and we try to push people out of their heads and into their heart. It comes down to there's the famous Maya Angelou quote that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. And
right.
So we focus on feeling so much, and if you learn a technique, it's about, it comes from a place of feeling and from your heart, and it's a very different thing. There's Compassionate Listening, another wonderful program that is great for creating this kind of empathy. In my opinion, it doesn't take it to the next step of how to resolve conflict and so forth, but it's a wonderful, there's great listening projects happening between Nazis and Jews, for example, Holocaust survivors and former Nazis, with that, Israelis, Palestinians, bringing people together and doing a lot of the same community building. And in fact, all of these programs I've found start to have a lot in common.
Mm-hmm.
As we fine-tune them and find out what works starts to drive all of the programs so that over time we look more and more like each other, frankly.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful. It's great to have a teaching, learning community among the practitioners. And we just have a couple of minutes left, and I was wondering if you have any other stories to share of where you feel people really had breakthroughs from working with you in the workshop. You talked about a couple of the inmates who went through the program and their responses to it, but do you have any other stories you wanted to share about the impact the workers had?
There is one that I'm fond of, and it was our very first veterans workshop, and we were only 2 or 3 hours into the workshop, and these two fellows walked up to us and said, whatever else happens, it's already been worth it.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, what are you talking about? And the one fellow was 6'4", black guy, his shoulders were 4 feet across. He was huge. And the other guy was a little white guy, about 5'8", but his shoulders were also about 4 feet across, and he looked like Hugh Jackman in Wolverine with the big mutton chops and very scary fellow. And they said, we've been gearing up for a fight for 3 weeks. And he said, and everybody in here wants us to fight. And it's been coming, and we've been getting closer and closer, and people are pushing us. And he said, when it happens, it wasn't going to be just us. It's got a racial element that was going to result in, you know, more and more people. These people are locked up in a unit of 83 people. So they were basically talking this was going to be a riot when the two of them fought. And they'd done a few of the exercises together, including this one on introducing yourself based on what you like about yourself. And they looked at me and both said, I like this guy. And they ended up being firm friends after this workshop. But just those few hours of being forced to talk to each other totally eliminated any possibility of them even thinking about fighting.
Yeah, well, it's not just being forced to talk to each other. It's about sharing from a deep place where you, in a structured way, which you learn your common humanity. That's really the game, because they could talk till they were blue in the face and still fight, except for the context that you create in your workshop. So good for you for doing that. So we just have another 2 minutes. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we sign off?
The most important thing is that anybody can do this. You know, if this interests you, if it's something you would be interested in doing, again, reach out to that email, info@avpusa.org, or the phone number. I believe you're going to post them both on the site.
Yes.
And that will, you know, call and ask how to get connected with the group. And you would start by going into prison and being a participant, or going into workshops as a participant wherever they're doing them. After you do several workshops, then you do a training for facilitators and you can join a team. It's less than 100 hours of training to be able to do this work. And it's some of the most rewarding stuff I think you can do. So I encourage folks to reach out and join us. It's fantastic.
Yeah, that sounds great. And it sounds like there's so many applications that could be made if we had more facilitators trained and able to do it, you know, as you say, branching out from the prisons, going into the schools, into the where domestic violence has been a problem for our veterans, and really even a third of the people in the general population need something. So thank you so much for being on the show and for all your important work. Thank you, Roger Cluck.
Thank you so much, Eleanor. Take care.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. We'll be posting the information discussed here on Progressive Radio Network on the web, prn.fm, in the Lecain Archives, L-E-C-A-I-N. I'll be back next week. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor Lecain with All Together Now.